Before I start on our readings for today, and this is our second to last class, we're coming to the end of the winter term of the Bible study. I thought I'd share with you, if you're not familiar with these, and it could be you are, but favorite Lenten movies of mine. You know, Lent is always a time that I try to watch some of these. Man for All Seasons. It could be all of you have seen that, but if you haven't, this is like my favorite saint movie, and it's Saint Thomas More. And an important thing to know about Man for All Seasons, if you're not familiar with it, it was written by Robert Bolt. Robert Bolt is also the one who did the script for The Mission, if you've ever seen The Mission. But Robert Bolt is not Christian. I don't think he's a believer at all. But he was somebody who, I think, in either high school or college, kind of discovered the writings and kind of life of St. Thomas More. And he thought, this is just a great guy. And so when you're watching A Man for All Seasons, a lot of the lines in it that are Thomas More's dialogue, those are taken right from his writings. He is not, you know, just making stuff up. He is there's a frame that's obviously historical. There are things that we have in sort of as records and whatnot. But he is as much as possible trying to have Thomas More speak in his own voice. So this is first a play. And then it was turned into a movie, Paul Scofield. There are a lot of real wonderful actors. Leo McKern is Thomas Cranmer, who's wonderful. The old and somewhat corpulent Orson Welles as Cardinal Wolsey. Just a wonderful cast. But what you're hearing with Thomas More is Thomas More. Bernadette, you're all familiar with the song for Bernadette with Judy Jones. This Bernadette movie was, I want to say, made in the 80s with a Canadian actress, Sidney Penney. And I like its kind of simplicity, and it's not, saint movies can be have a lot of drama to them. And this is more low-key. It's not as, there isn't swelling dramatic music all the time. And I have a real soft spot for it. And Sidney Penney plays Bernadette as really just a very simple French peasant girl. And they're just one of my favorite moments in it. Remember, Our Lady is appearing to her, and the parish priest asks, well, find out who she is. You know, ask her who she is. So the next scene, you see Bernadette coming up from the grotto, and the whole way she's walking, she's saying, I am the Immaculate Conception. I am the Immaculate. Because this is a girl who really is not like the sharpest tool in the drawer. So she has to sit there and like recite this to herself all the way up from the grotto. So she finally gets to the phrase, I am the Immaculate Conception. What? I am the Immaculate Conception. That's what she told me. That's who she is. I am the Immaculate Conception. So it's just, there's so many lovely moments in that movie. Finally, a movie that you may not be familiar with, Pascal. Pascal was made for Italian television by Roberto Rossellini, who, right, the probably know him as the husband of Ingrid Bergman. But and so it's in Italian with subtitles. But if you're not familiar with Pascal, Pascal was a French mathematician, 1600s, and through the influence of his sister, and who was a nun, and other people in his life, he has just this profound conversion experience. And not only does the movie, I think, do a kind of arresting job of bringing you into like who Pascal is and this experience of his, but it also shows you this world in which he lives in the 1600s, in which there's the beginnings of modern science, at the same time that there are. They're having an examination of a woman who's suspected of being a witch. All these things are happening. Pascal is the one who essentially invents the barometer, who figures out atmospheric pressure. All these things are happening at the same time. So it's kind of there's a lot of depth to it as a kind of a saint movie. But those are ones that I find that I keep going back to and I really enjoy.
Is that out of focus, do you think?
Is it on
Pascal? Focus the
I'm looking blank. This is my blank look.
You know, the website, you know, Tim Gray.
I know nothing about it.
Oh.
So it might be. Go and look.
Forum. I'm sorry. Forum.
Now, Formed I have heard of, but I just, I don't get a lot of time in the computer
Forum,
lately. So
Forum, all the parishes have, well, not all the parishes, but a lot of parishes have
memberships.
You can pick a
yeah, and so anyway, yeah, it may be on there. I get these out of the library. Yeah, that's. I sort of thoughtlessly just get things out of Hennepin County. So that these are things may all be available online. I don't. Yeah. So to the task for today, 2 Kings 22:23, and we have the lovely story of Josiah after, and it's all the more lovely after just one horrendous king after another. You just start to lose heart. But one of the things that I think is a good start, when you look at Josiah's reforms. So let's see. Starting at verse 4 on chapter 23. The king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, the keepers of the threshold, to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels made for Baal, for Ashereth, for all the hosts of heaven. And they burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron and carried the ashes to Bethel. He deposed the idolatrous priests who the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places at the city of Judah and round about Jerusalem. Also those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun, the moon, the constellations, the hosts of heaven. He brought out the Ashereth from the house of the Lord outside Jerusalem to the brook of Kidron and burned it at the brook Kidron and beat it to dust and cast the dust upon the graves of the common people. He broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes, which were in the house of the Lord, where the women wove hangings for Asherah, and brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burnt incense from Geba to Beersheba, and broke down the high places of the gates were at the entrance of Joshua, the governor of the city. Now, this is what, I take the time to read that, because this is what it is that Josiah grew up with. That's the thing to, I think you have to think about this in terms of his reform. This was his upbringing. This is the world in which he came in and grew up and lived. This is, formed him in the sense that this is what was around him. So that he, as a young king, would take to himself tearing all these things down. You know, there is something really special about this guy. This guy has, if you like, all the way that we excuse bad behavior. He came from a bad neighborhood. You know, he came from, you look at his family. Is it any surprise? You know, the way that we sort of casually, or you'll hear casually people talk that way. Wordsworth puts it particularly well in his commentary. I want to get this exact. What a vast difference is made by divine grace in human obedience. Manasseh began to reign at 12 years, Josiah at 8. Manasseh was bred under Hezekiah, a pious father. Josiah under Ammon, a godless one. And yet Manasseh was an idolater, but Josiah was holy and devout. Let no one who sins impute his sins to his circumstances, but to himself. Sure. Let no one who sins, see, that's why I wanted to quote it exactly. Let no one who sins impute his sins to his circumstances, but to himself. Okay? You know, when you hear that people turn to crime because they're poor, really? All poor people turn to crime? What an insult to all the people who are poor and law-abiding. When people say, well, it's an inner city neighborhood. That's why he's in a gang. What an insult to all the people who grow up in the inner city who are not in gangs. The circumstances of your life don't cause. They are things that certainly dispose. No question about it disposing. And there's no question that there are circumstances in which it's very hard to swim against the tide. But what we have here in Isaiah is, or in Josiah, is somebody who grew up with, I mean, listen to that catalog of things, statues to Baal and vessels to Baal in the temple itself. Okay? All of these things are, if you like, normal. And there has to be a way that as you're growing up and growing with that, that you are somehow able to look at that and just say, that is wrong. You know, as from your youth, from your childhood, to be able to look at it and just say, this is wrong. This needs to stop. You know, that we'd have to say is unusual, but at the same time, it's a kind of a standard that we're all held to. I wrote up here just because there's so much good in it, and I'll share some of it with you. I've mentioned already John Henry Cardinal Newman's plain and parochial sermons. These are sermons that he gave in the 1830s, and he gave them as an Anglican chaplain at St. Mary's, which was at Oxford. That's where a lot of the students went at Oxford. And Newman, when he's giving sermons, yes, he's coming out of this Anglican tradition, but a lot of what he's talking about, this is anybody who is traditionally Christian, in other words, you derive your inspiration from how it is that Scripture has been interpreted through the ages and kind of not modern innovations, these sermons are going to have a lot to say to you. And Newman, more than anyone else, for my money, has been the most helpful for me at seeing the people in the Old Testament in their characters, in their humanity, you know, not just as, you know, names in a story or you know, that they have real personalities and choices and so on. So there are 8 volumes to these sermons. They're all available online at newmanreader.org. If you go to newmanreader.org, I think there's a tab for works. When you tab onto the works, you'll see there's quite a bit from John Henry Newman. But fairly early on, you'll see these parochial and plain sermons. And in volume 8, sermon 7, he has a whole sermon on Josiah. And it's called Josiah, A Pattern to the Ignorant. And he again, says this thing that you just, that similar to what you just heard in Wordsworth. As if to show us that religion, depends on a man's self, under God who gives grace, on the state of the heart and not on outward circumstances. Manasseh was the son of pious Hezekiah. Josiah, the son of wicked Ammon. Josiah had not the aid of a revealed volume, at least not of the law. He was surrounded by the diversities of idol worship, the sophistries of unbelief, the seductions of sinful pleasure. He had every temptation to go wrong. And had he done so, we might make allowances and said he was not so bad as other kings, for he knew no better. He had not sinned against the light. Yes, he would have sinned against the light. The event shows it. For if he had light enough to go right, which he did, for he did go right, it follows that if he had gone wrong, it would have been against the light. Not indeed so strong and clear a light as Solomon disobeyed or Joash, still, against his better knowledge. This is very important. Everyone, even the poorest and most ignorant, has knowledge enough to be religious. Education does not make a man religious, nor again is it an excuse for man's disobedience, that he has not been educated in his duty. It only makes him less guilty than those who have been educated. That is all. He is still guilty. Here I say, the poorest and most unlearned among us may take a lesson from a Jewish king. Scarcely can anyone in a Christian land be in a more disadvantageous circumstances than Josiah. Nay, scarcely in a heathen. He had idolatry around him, and at the age he began to seek God, his mind was unformed. What then was it that guided him? Whence his knowledge? He had that which all men have, heathen as well as Christian, till they pervert or blunt it, a natural sense of right and wrong. And he did not blunt it. So one of the things that I talk about with sophomores as we're reading Mere Christianity, they're now in the second part of Mere Christianity, What Christians Believe, if you're familiar with the book. And Lewis will talk toward the end of the first part, what is it that human beings can sort of naturally know about God? Well, when you look at the universe, if you just look at the world around you, you might look at the universe and think God is a great artist. there's so much that's beautiful in the universe. But you might also think that God's a little merciless and uncaring, right? The universe is a dangerous place. You know, nature is not very forgiving when you make mistakes against nature. Probably a better way into what God is like, Lewis says, is from the moral law. And you know more about God from the moral law in your heart, just as you know more about a person from listening to his conversation than you would from things that, let's say, he's building or making. And so one of the things they told the sophomores drawing out of that was the moral law is the first and most basic way in which God is having a conversation with you. So if you think God talks to me, that's like, that happens in prayer, that mystics, crazy people, that's who, you know, hears things from God or hears voices from God. Nope. Every human being has an inner conversation that comes from God. The first and most basic way that God reveals himself to everyone is through the moral law on your conscience. And do you listen to that conversation? Do you engage in that conversation? Are you trying to find the remote with the mute button? Are you trying to turn it down? That's the basic way that God is talking to you. And so I will tell them, probably at some point when you're raised as a Christian, when you're raised religious, it dawns on you, you know, I have these things that like other people don't have. What about all these other people who aren't raised Catholic or aren't raised Lutheran or aren't raised evangelical or aren't raised, don't go to church, don't have a Bible? How do they have a chance? The thing you need to understand is that God speaks to everyone through that moral law written on the heart. God is speaking to everyone. If you are someone who is not raised with religion, in fact, if you're raised like Josiah in a place of just religious confusion, that conversation with the moral law in your heart is the thing that's going to allow you to come to the truth. If you are raised in the right religion and you just never really want to engage in that conversation, you know, that conversation that God is trying to have with you in your heart is just not really interesting to you or is just kind of a bother, you are not going to be able to stay religious. That conversation that happens in the heart is utterly foundational. It's the thing that allows you to come to religion if you don't have it. It's really the thing that your religion is building on when you're being raised with it. But there's no substitute for it. There's no substitute for it. The reason at this school that we spend all year long in the sophomore year trying to get the moral law into their heads is because we are convinced that unless they have that, they will not be evangelized. It isn't just like C.S. Lewis is so smart and C.S. Lewis is so intellectual and, well, they're doing all these other intellectual things. Why shouldn't they do this intellectual thing? No, it's because if they are not convinced of there being a moral law that is in their heart, written on their heart, speaking through their conscience, they will not really be able to embrace and accept Christ. It won't happen. There's no such thing as accepting Christ without understanding yourself as a sinner who is breaking a law that is written on your heart that's been put there by the God who wants to save you. Right? To have religion apart from a moral law written on the heart is imaginary. It is imaginary. It is not real. And the beautiful thing in this story is that you see God speaking to Josiah, not like it is with let's say Samuel, right? There's this voice. He's speaking to his heart in this young man looking at the idolatry around him and all the things that are connected with it, like child sacrifice and male prostitution, and knows there is simply something ugly and wrong about this. By the way, again, another great passage for understanding that where you have religious error, there is moral decadence. That especially with our young people, when they think about the chosen people coming into the promised land and executing judgment on them, and they think, well, this is just a different religion. It's not just a different religion. Not when you have male prostitution. Not where you have the sacrifice of children. There are moral distortions that are part of idolatry. As this is happening, as he commits to this reform, we hear in verse 20 or in chapter 22, in the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent Shaphan the son of Azaliah, the son of a lot of names right in a row. Meshulam, secretary of the house of the Lord, go to Hilkiah, the high priest. And what is he doing? He's reckoning the money for the repairs for the temple. Remember, this is something we talked about earlier. Wherever a king is identified as being like David, there's some kind of connection to the temple. This is a king not like David. There's some kind of harm coming to the temple. A king like David, there's at least with Hezekiah the effort to repair the temple, an effort that didn't go very far. But with Josiah, it's more intentional and more successful. In fact, we're even lovely detail that, you know, we're making sure we're paying the workmen. We're making sure we're paying these guys. That, in other words, that putting the investment. You know, there was a fellow who came to La Crosse years ago that talked about how it is that it was a stewardship talk. It was a good stewardship talk. Usually a stewardship talk, you think they're trying to shake me down. But this is a stewardship talk that what you put your money in is a kind of a statement of what's important to you. So when you look at a budget, you budget your money. In a way, budgeting, yes, you could talk about it from a prudential point of view. But there's something about budgeting that's also a form of self-knowledge, right? When I write down this budget and when I look at what's going where, what does that say about me? What does that say about what I consider important and what I, you know, what I put my money in? That's a kind of a statement about yourself. So that we get the detail of him making sure these guys are paid, that he's putting out the money for it. Because remember, we've had plenty of stories before where you don't put money in the temple, you take money out. The temple is like the king's bank in times of emergency. So this in a way is a kind of testimony to the goodness of Isaiah or Josiah, that he's putting the money into the temple. Verse 8, Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan. He read it. Shaphan brought it to the king. Right? They read it aloud. Verse 11, when the king heard the words of the book of the Lord, he tore his clothes. Okay? So what has been happening here? Right? We're getting a kind of a clearer picture. Not only do we have a temple that's filled with all this Baal paraphernalia, not only do we have these high places and places of idolatrous worship right outside of Jerusalem and right around, but they have gotten to the point where they've even just sort of lost track of the book. They've lost track of the book of the law. And so they discover it. You could say discover it by accident, but again, the pattern of Josiah is where you seek the Lord, he is going to make himself more known to you. You know, this is one of these knock and, you know, seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be open to you. Because he seeks it, right? It makes itself known. When I read the story, the first thing I was reminded of, there was a parish in Wisconsin. I'll conceal the parish to protect the guilty, but they had a renovation, and they just gutted all the traditional, like the art, the carvings, the altar rails. It just got all torn out, and they made it kind of this. Almost like Calvinist meeting house, you know, where everything's sort of whitewashed and empty, and that's supposed to be more spiritual. They did another, I want to say about 15 years ago, they went back and they did a renovation, and it was really a restoration. They wanted to kind of put it more like it was. There were things that they wanted to update in terms of materials and whatnot, you know, things that were just wearing out. But otherwise, they wanted to kind of restore it to where it was. And they got to the altar rails, and they wanted to put back in the altar rails. And they were looking at costs and how expensive it was and what are we going to do. And this old farmer comes up to the pastor and says, you know, are you serious about the altar rails? And he said, yeah, it's just, it's expensive. And, you know, you can get altar rails, but it looks very cheesy. And if you get the real ones, that's real cost. And the farmer says, I have them. Oh. I said, what do you mean? He said, when they gutted the church, they were gonna smash up the altar rails. So I talked to the stonemason who was doing the work, and I got them from him because he was gonna destroy them anyway. They're in my barn. Mm-hmm. He had kept these altar rails for 40 years. You know, this was a project in the 70s, and now, you know, here it is, 2010. And it's, I thought of that, but there are these things, you know, right? They were despised. And yet, you know, somehow, somewhere, you know, they were hidden and preserved for a later age. Okay? And I just think of how many, my father had this wonderful library of church fathers, and there were scripture commentaries in there. It took up kind of a wall of his bookshelf in their house, and he had gotten most of those books from a dumpster from a seminary of a religious order that I will conceal the name to protect the guilty. They had just taken all these church fathers and doctors and patrology and lives of the saints and just put them in the dumpster. And my father saw all this and said, well, you're throwing these out anyway. Can I have them? And they said, yeah, sure. I mean, you're interested in that sort of thing. And after when we came back from the funeral, I'm looking at, you know, this wall of theology books and so on. And my brother-in-law sort of, you know, comes up sort of quietly to me and says, they're mine. And that's fine. I got plenty of books. But my brother-in-law, he's probably in his early 30s. He's a lawyer. Went to a small Catholic school that was kind of very on track as a Catholic school. And this is a guy, though, he's not, you know, a theologian or something like that, but he's a serious Catholic, and he knows that this is what you ought to have. So here's this younger generation that my father sort of rescued these books from the dumpster, and my brother-in-law knows this is it. This is St. Augustine, St. John Chrysostom, Bible. This is it. This is what you want to kind of have on yourself. So that, but notice the reaction as they're reading the law that, you rend your garments, you weep. Yeah, go ahead.
Can we go back a second? So, because we're trying to figure, so where had these books been? Where had it, was it supposed to be kept in the temple? Were people supposed to be looking at it?
Yeah.
So it just disappeared because of all the other stuff going on and all these bad.
Yeah, the book is supposed to be in the temple because it's, the book gives you the directions. It's your sort of, Karen, correct me on this, but it's sort of your combination lectionary missal. In a way, it's giving you directions for the rituals, but it's also giving you what you need to understand the law, right? What is the law? Where did it come from? Why are you supposed to keep it? All of that's what's understood. Karen, if you want to add to that.
Well, Deuteronomy is kind of unique in that it has our profession of faith. Like you guys...
We get it. We get it.
Say the profession of faith.
Like the creed.
Yeah.
You have a creedal statement. Yep.
Well, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, Deuteronomy 6:4, and following is our profession of faith. So the profession of faith, and it gives the instructions, you shall teach them to your children when you walk upon the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, when you shall put them on the doorposts of your gates. You shall speak of them when you're on the way, etc.
Right.
So there's a direction there. And then it also goes into what's supposed to be in the temple, how it's supposed to be organized, what the job of the priests are, and things like that. So it literally goes from profession of faith, acknowledging the Ten Commandments, and then how you do things.
Right. So that's the other thing that I would add is not just sort of... lectionary missal, but also daily devotional. Like when, you know, folks who have their Magnificat, and this is sort of their guide for, oh, this helps my morning prayer, this helps my evening prayer, this gives me a reflection. The reason they rend their garments is, I think they read this thing and they realize how little of it they're doing. How little, if any, of it they're doing. Yeah, so it's a rebuke going through the law is just a series of rebukes in terms of where they're living. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So they've been really, but King, they've been ignoring it for generations.
Generations. Remember, it's bad enough that we have the temple, you know, decorated with all of this other pagan things. You know, that's what's in that's just become normal. And you have people like Manasseh, who, remember, we don't have this in Kings, we have it in Chronicles, that in his old age he's captured, he comes back, he tries a reform. But one of the things that becomes clear is that his reform is only partially successful, because it's like he moves things like out of the city, but they're like right on the city limits, so that when Ammon comes in, all he has to do is pull them all back. You know, the reform of Manasseh is largely, you know, impotent. It is too little too late. That's why I have this line right here: religious reform, grassroots or top down. If you work in go ahead.
One more point about
Please.
The rending of the garments.
Yep.
At my grandparents' funeral, the rabbi walked up to all of us, and there was a piece of cloth, and it was rent, it was torn, and it's a sign of, even when I'm talking about it, it's a sign of intense mourning.
Yep.
Because they walk up to you and say, you are now in a period of mourning, and you...
Right.
And this is ripped.
Right.
It used to be in the old days that you would actually take a garment and rip it, but now we substitute a piece of cloth.
But
it's when it happens to you, when that piece of cloth is ripped, the sense of mourning just drops down on you. I mean, it's super intense. So when it's not just like, oh, I ripped my clothing.
No,
sorry.
No.
It's like, I can't even describe to you the intensity of that.
Yeah, so that's when I use the word rebuke, there are things in our religious experience. There are a lot of things that we hear and sort of they wash over us. But you can read something and all of a sudden you're convicted. Mm-hmm. You see yourself in what's being described. By the way, that is a frequent experience that I have with Newman. It's one of the reasons I keep going back to Newman. He will talk about, there is a certain kind of believer who does this and does this, and he fancies himself devout, but he does this and he does it. Me! He's talking about me! there are just these moments of conviction. And so when the priest is reading from the law, Josiah's feeling is not, oh, how long is this reading going to be? No, these are not people who are, these are not souls who are in a position to just feel, oh, another long reading. They are, what they are hearing is striking them to the center. Okay, again, like if you remember Augustine's Confessions, there's a point in book 8 where Augustine is hearing about the lives of these converts, these people who were professors of rhetoric or people who were in positions of power and influence, and what they did, what was necessary or the kind of hard choices they made to embrace Christ, to come into the church. And Augustine hears in these stories, these are people who are like you. They are biting the bullet. They are doing what's necessary. And what are you doing? And the phrase that he has that's, I think, a very helpful one is he talks about how it is that I was forced to face myself. I, who had been behind myself, was now brought round and forced to see. Keep thinking of the David Bowie song. I turned myself to face me, but I never caught a glimpse. This is like the opposite of that. No, he actually is forced. And that's when he breaks down. You know, so there are things in scripture, or fathers or doctors, or what we hear in preaching, they may sort of, they're like rain on a roof. They sort of go over us. But the experience that Josiah is having is that experience of conviction, that he sees himself in what he hears, that he knows, not just for himself, but for the people, that they are not living as God has intended them to live. Even in this sort of brief period of Reformation, which culminates in this great Passover, Josiah can't help but be aware that ultimately, as has been prophesied to Hezekiah, this is coming to an end. This is not some kind of permanent restoration. That's what I was going to make with this point. In social service circles, you will talk about doing things grassroots. That is, all the people are sort of on board with you, and now you're going to, like, the establishment or the power and making your needs known. Or there are these things that are top down, right? You've got these organizations and you are going out and, like, directing and telling people, here's where you need to be, here's what you really need, even if you're not fully aware of it. Okay. Needless to say, there's always a kind of a prejudice for grassroots. That's an understandable prejudice, because notice that whether it's Hezekiah, whether it's Manasseh, whether now it's Josiah, when they try reforms, those reforms are always top down. They've got the power, so they can knock things down and they can defile these pagan shrines, they can haul away the statues and whatnot, but the default keeps going back to this idolatry and to this paganism. Okay? Because that's, if you like, where the people are at. The kings either go along with it and enable it, or they try to resist it. But the problem is, these people already are disposed in the wrong way. So it's a lot easier to enable it and fight against it. All of these reforms, you'll notice they don't outlast the ruler. They don't outlast the ruler. The ruler dies. It's not just because the person who comes after is a godless person. The person who comes after can very well simply say, do I really believe what Dad was modeling? Do I really buy into this thing that Dad believed? Do I really want to go against what it is that all the people are practicing? Okay? So that's why I wrote down Manasseh and Ammon. Manasseh, even in his reform, there is some kind of genuine repentance there, but the reform is sort of half-hearted. It's like he pushes things out of city limits. But at the point where you're just pushing things out of city limits, it's almost like, okay, we're a dry county, and then there are like all these liquor stores right on the other side of the county line. You aren't really stopping the problem. Okay. I heard. Nope.
I was just chuckling.
Go ahead.
So Indiana and Michigan, Indiana had blue laws.
Yes.
So they couldn't sell liquor on Sundays. There was literally a liquor store called State Line Liquors that.
Yes.
Butts the state line.
Yep.
From Michigan to Indiana.
Yep.
If it had to happen on Sundays, that's where he went.
So I like that. In fact, I think I've driven by that place now that I think about it. State Line Liquors. There were similar when I lived in Louisiana. There were parts, not Louisiana, but there were parts of Mississippi that were dry. But then, again, you would have the county line liquors or whatever that would be right on the other side. Yep, go ahead.
So the Book of Laws was in the temple when Solomon built the temple then.
Yep.
And then when they said that it was lost by the time of David, according to the readings.
What do you mean lost by the time?
Yeah, so
you
could, the practice wasn't the
well.
Practice
I think the Book of Laws. They said somewhere in the reading that the Book of Laws wasn't around like during the time of David. So basically, all those laws that were instituted by God were not being practiced all those years up until Josiah found.
I'm looking at you perplexed because that isn't sounding right to me. But
I think we talked about that yesterday. It was the Passover that had passed throughout, but this was lost from Manasseh.
Yeah. Yeah, so
not as far back.
So what they say when they have the great Passover, as it's described here, how does it end? It's in 21. verse 21 of chapter 23. The king commanded all the people, keep the Passover to the Lord, as is written in the book of the covenant. For no such Passover had been kept since the days of the judges who judged Israel, or during all the days of the kings of Israel or the kings of Judah. Now, when I was reading about this in the commentaries, it wasn't saying that like there wasn't a script for it or something. It was saying that how much attention, how much devotion, how many people are showing up, how seriously are they taking it. The claim here is that this was the most observant Passover that they ever had. Yeah, so it's not that they didn't have the script for it. It's just as time went on, they simply didn't take it as seriously. They go ahead, Karen.
It would be like, and please forgive me, because I knew about this like as a non-Catholic, even as a Jewish person, that you guys would have polka masses.
Sure.
And if so, it would be like...
There are still polka masses in Wisconsin.
So
not making it up.
You would have polka masses. That's what they had been observing up until this point. And then it's like going all the way back and have putting back the communion rails, putting everything back as it was in pre-Vatican II.
Yep.
You know, so... That's the comparison I can kind of give you.
Yep.
Sort of.
No, that puts it nicely.
It's a polka mass.
So in western Wisconsin, especially where the populations are heavily Polish, once a year usually in late fall, they'll have a mass where instead of the music, being let's say the organ or whatnot, they'll be a polka band. So they'll do the Lamb of God and all the things that are the parts of the Mass plus the hymns are played with polka music. Now this was something, by the way, that I remember one bishop trying to bring a stop to it, but the parish pointed out this is the biggest moneymaker the parish has. We collect more money during that polka Mass than any other Mass in the year. And the bishop pointed out, well, but couldn't you have the polka like after the Mass or before the Mass or so on? And the pastor pointed out, where do we get the money? They give it during the collection. They are paying for the polka. So what do you want? Do you want us to get rid of the polka and now we can't make our cathedraticum and we can't make the contribution that you expect us to bring to the diocese? Or do you want to put up with the polka Mass and now we can pay the bills? Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that originated in Poland or in the United States?
No, in the United States. All those things originate in the United States.
So just tell me that John Paul II did not do that.
No. No. All those things start in the United States. So
Wisconsin, Polish, just to be clear.
Anyway, but Karen makes a good point. There are things which are traditional, which you just lose sense of. This is the thing I was trying to point out last time. There are so many Lenten devotions, things that are part of Lent, that I think most ordinary Catholics, they have no idea what they are. They don't know what they are at all. Why? Because their mom never talked about them. It could be the mom didn't know them. And maybe grandma remembers them, but grandma doesn't talk about them. They're gone. And the only way that you would know them is like you dig up some old book, you find some old missal, you find some old church history, you find some life of the saint, and you read this thing and you realize, oh my gosh, I've got a completely panty waist Lent. You know? How am I, if I'm really having a penitential Lent, you know, it's more than the thing that I'm doing, it's more than the thing I'm giving up. But for many of us, you know, the only way we know these things is because we dug it up. You know, we looked and we sought for it. Very good. Next week, our last class, we'll bring a conclusion of the Book of Kings.